So welcome everyone to this CCWG on Enhancing Accountability Review of Draft Bylaws Meeting number 11 on April 2016. And well, actually it's the meeting of April 11th, not our 11th meeting on this. So it's good to see new faces. As I was saying, I can see for example Alberto Soto, who is joining this effort now. And welcome Alberto, welcome to all new faces, new voices in this group, and you'll find this quite entertaining and amusing. So welcome, just don't run away too soon. And well, we of course have been following the efforts on the lawyers and the group with their questions on the different adjustments and versions of the bylaws that we're trying to finalize so that they can be implemented. And one thing that is really important to state at this point is that we will be going through a number of issues and questions that have been raised by the group and in different channels. And what we would like to definitely avoid is to reopen issues that, as we have been continuously stating, this is not a phase in which we are going to reopen any issues, but rather to provide clear guidance to our lawyers to for them to actually have a finalized version on the bylaws that we wanted to implement. And I see that Caboose had a request for a statement. So I would definitely call on Caboose to please take the floor so we can listen to what you have to tell us. Caboose, you have the floor.
Do you hear me?
Yes, we hear you.
Yes, very from you. You have not been heard during the last two calls, so good to have you. Listen, learn. I have a very, very difficult task or time during the 2 hours before your meeting, and it is stated in the statement. We were discussing something, and somebody says that the ICANN bylaw is an American document and must be written according to American style. I strongly object to that statement. We are not preparing or drafting an American document. We're preparing ICANN bylaw as a multi-stakeholder communities, a global multi-stakeholder communities. We are not under a specific style of a specific country. We are under the general agreement, so I don't agree to follow a specific style. I strongly to that statement that there was a group of people harmonizing with each other and making such a statement, and one after the other, to support that. This is not correct. This is totally wrong. In addition, there was a legal lawyer from the city. He took the entire floor and imposed her position to us and insisted and so on and so forth, and even did not allow to talk, did not allow to listen, and the chairman was unfortunately unable to control the meeting. The meeting is CCWG, and CCWG is called Cross Community Working Group. It's not American group. I know 80% are American. I know 80% are GMSO, but I don't agree with that. We should listen to each other, and we should work with each other quietly, nicely, calmly, in a healthy environment. So please clarify this issue. If you are going to draft the document under the American sun, I cannot agree with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Caboose, for this statement. I see that Greg Shatton's hand is up. But before I go to Greg, I would like to point out that however inclusive and diverse we have been through these many calls and meetings, we cannot refuse the fact that ICANN is a California for-profit corporation. So in that sense, any language that we put into the bylaws must comply with California law and, of course, U.S. law. In regard to U.S. style, I am not sure what we could understand by U.S. style, but I would definitely encourage everyone to keep our minds open and continue to do our work as we have with the inclusiveness and diversity that we have so far used in this group. So I will now go to Greg. And Greg, can I ask you to please be as concise as possible?
I'll be at least as concise as Cavus. Thank you. It's Greg Chatton for the record. Cavus is carrying over a discussion that we had this morning in the CWG meeting, reviewing the bylaws. So I'm sorry to waste your time, but I feel I need to state my side of the case, which it was pretty much everybody's side of the case, but Cavus on that call. All that was being said is that since we're drafting a document that is a U.S. law document, it needs to comply with U.S. law, and that when in choosing specific terms and words to put into the document, we should choose words understanding their meaning under U.S. law and choose terms of art such as reasonable efforts that have a meaning that has been tested time and time again in U.S. courts and where there is a basis for a common understanding of those words. This was not some sort of hijacking by U.S. interests of the document. What we're trying to provide here is a document that says what it means and means what it says, nothing more than that. And the best way to do that is to use the tools, words, that have settled meanings in drafting documents that are interpreted under U.S. law. If anybody thinks that sounds crazy, please say so. I think it's not only rational, but absolutely necessary. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Greg. So I would definitely encourage to not continue deep diving into this philosophical discussion. And I would rather carry out with the agenda. And Cavus, if you are interested in continuing the discussion, we definitely encourage you to continue this on the mailing list. So with that, I would go back to the opening remarks and state that, as I was saying, we should definitely not reopen issues, but rather focus on guiding our lawyers as to how they can best reflect what our report states on each recommendation and, of course, translate it into bylaws that we can finalize and continue the process. So with that, I will turn to my co-chair, Thomas, for the next agenda item.
Thank you very much, Leon, and hello, everyone, to this call where we're hopefully going to resolve most, if not all, of the questions that have been brought up by the lawyers as well as by our group. The second agenda item will hopefully be a swift one, and that is to confirm the responses that we've discussed during the last call. You might remember that Bernie has thankfully circulated two documents on Friday, one document containing the summary of the answers that we have worked on and confirmed, and the second document with the open issues. So let me now ask whether any one of you has further comments on the questions that we had agreed during the last call. So the audio has not dropped. Let's just wait for another couple of seconds. Okay, no one seems to see the need to speak to the previously agreed answers, so we can take those as adopted. Let's then focus on the remaining issues. And as a leadership team, we've been thinking about ways to make it as easy as possible for the whole group to follow the discussion and also either confirm answers proposed or comment on those. In order to help with this, we have prepared a couple of slides, and I would like to ask staff to bring those up in the Adobe. We thought that it would be cumbersome for you to work through an 18-page document in the remote participation room, and therefore we have tried to summarize the pending issues on a couple of slides. We will walk you through those, and you will have the opportunity to speak to the individual issues. In broad terms, we think that we have three different categories of issues that need to be resolved, the first of which are issues that really need some discussion. Then we have uncontested comments. Maybe it's too broad or too brave a statement to say that these comments were uncontested. Maybe some of you have just been waiting for a good opportunity to comment, but at least we haven't seen any traffic on those comments, so maybe we can take those comments and observations by some of you as quick wins to get responses to all the items. And then we have some questions from our group where individuals were uncertain as to what specific areas of the draft bylaws meant and how they should be understood. So during this call, what we would like to do is go through all the issues with you. We have regrouped them slightly because some of the commenters have spoken to the same issues. So, for example, when it comes to reconsideration requests as well as the IRP, there were numerous questions on those that have been in different places in the 18-page document, and we've tried to put them all together so that we can talk about different subjects one after the other, so that you don't need to go back and forth. So let's move to the next slide, please. Actually, the way this is displayed on my screen is a little bit broken, but it might just be me. So the now I at least can see question one, additional question number 13, surrounding the words in the root zone, or the root zone, on my screen. So I hope that's the same for you as well. So let's discuss this now. Actually, this the slides are doing some gymnastics in my Adobe room. That's quite nice to see. So there has been a lot of discussion around the words in the root zone in ICANN's mission, and I would suggest let's not get trapped by these three words. Let's try to agree on the essence of what we're trying to achieve, which I would like to summarize as follows, and that is that ICANN is not in charge overall of names in the DNS. ICANN has policy authority over what labels go into the root zone, and this is the reason why some of you have argued and many have agreed that we should keep the words in the root zone opposite to what we had initially discussed, and that the fact that ICANN can actually do something about second names, for example, would be adequately captured by conditions that can be included in the registry and registrar agreements within the picket fence. So many of you have agreed with
that.
Yes, Becky, I'll turn to you momentarily. Some of you have agreed with Andrew and others, and Becky has also confirmed that she would be okay with keeping the words in the root zone. Becky, you would like to make a comment on that, please.
Yes, I think that ICANN's point was well taken. Before we had rearranged the bylaws to bring the picket fence up into the description of the mission respecting names, but now that the picket fence is there, it's clear what is within ICANN's mission, and so I think that going back and reinserting the root zone language is appropriate.
Thanks very much, Becky. So unless there are further comments on this one, we would like to pass on these instructions to the lawyers, and that means that we would include the words in the root zone. Awesome. Let's move to the next slide then, and that is with respect to question number two, and that is the scope of grandparenting. And I've actually made it gender neutral, following one of Cavus's earlier comments. What we would like to capture here is that, again, let's not try to get trapped by the word grandparenting, but we had discussed in our report that we would like to ensure that existing registry and registrar agreements can be renewed. We wanted to ensure that applicants of the current round of new GTLDs can sign the registry agreement in the currently used form, and the terms and conditions of new form GTLD registry and registrar agreements are not grandfathered. Since that is a question falling into Becky's scope as well, let me ask Becky whether there's anything to add to that proposed outline of an answer.
I have nothing to add to that.
Excellent. Would any one of you like to comment on this? That doesn't seem to be the case, so let's capture this as the outcome, and we will respond to the lawyers accordingly. Let's move to the next slide. That relates to question number six from the original document we received from the legal drafting team, and that related to the right of the ICANN board to remove colleagues. And as you might remember, and we've discussed this during our previous call, this power for the board to remove colleagues has not been touched by our report. And therefore, we want to preserve that right for the board, and therefore one of the instructions to the lawyers is that the board must be able to remove colleagues. Formal requirements must be baked into the bylaws so that no formal consent or approval or any other declaration of will is required by the empowered community. And the CCWG recommendations do not suggest that the approval or any other decision from the EC is required to exercise that power. There has been some discussion and some concerns have been raised that we might face a situation where the empowered community tries to place an individual on the board and the board then immediately removes that director, and that this could destabilize the organization. We've then concluded on the list that should something like that occur, there is still the power for the empowered community to remove the board, because such action by the board would certainly be considered rogue, and therefore it might not be appropriate for us to try to doctor the process that the board has to remove colleagues in order to avoid that risk, but rather then remove the entire board. Are there any comments on that? That is great. Thanks so much. There's support in the chat for this, and I see that the slides have been reformatted miraculously by staff. That's great. Thank you so much for doing this so quickly. So with that, we can move to the next slide. That relates to question number 29 and additional question number 22. It relates to removing non-com board members. And there was a discussion around the carve-out, whether or not the carve-out should be applicable. And we had asked the lawyers to reframe the question, because in the group's view, or at least in some of in our group's views, reference to the GAC car about was not correct. While we haven't received anything on that so far, we think that the answer is moot anyway, because the carve-out would not be applicable to individual board member removal anyway. And therefore, we would like to suggest to you, and we hope that you agree with us, that the lawyers should just ensure that no mentioning of the carve-out is made in the bylaws when it comes to individual board member removal. I see that there's a comment in the chat from Brett. Sorry, I was away. I disagree firmly that the CCWG recommendations do not suggest that the approval or any other decision from the EC is required to exercise that power. That goes back to question number six. So, Brett, maybe you can point us to a place in the report where reference to that that power was made. We have not made any recommendations to speak to that power that the board has. And as you know, in this phase of our work, it is our job just to ensure whether the bylaw drafting is consistent with our report. And since there's no reference to that, to altering that board power, I think, are not in the position to do it at this stage. Cavus, your hand is going up and down, so I trust that you do want to take the floor. Please,
Matthew, may I speak about that? I understand if that's the... you referenced my name, so I didn't... I thought you were asking me a question.
This is Brett, if you could just pause for a second. This is Thomas, by the way. I had just given Cavus the floor, who had raised his hand, and I will get back to you momentarily.
Can I talk, please?
Please do, Cavus.
Yes, Thomas. I think I sent several emails to yourself, to others, about the extent of the carve-out, and I hope that you will raise or address that point at some time. Thank you.
Thanks, Cavus. We will have a dedicated slide on the carve-out. So if you just wait for a couple of minutes, you will see it. Brett, you wanted to take the floor as well. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Okay. If we're going to be holding strongly and firmly to the principle that is not included in the report, that it will not be included in our recommendations or in the bylaws, I would hope that standard would also apply to the GAC carve-out, because there is no restriction whatsoever on the terms or limits under which the GAC carve-out should apply. Any kind of effort to impose a standard about substantially based on or any other caveat along those lines should not be included in the bylaws as well. It should apply to every single bit of a board decision that ever relies on or relates to GAC consensus advice. So if we're going to apply this standard strictly, I hope that it is applied strictly across the board. Thank you.
Thanks, Brett. Becky, would you like to comment on this?
I'm not really sure I think that we had no authority, and, well, I don't know if we had authority or not, but we did not do anything to alter the board's ability to remove members on its own. And so I'm not sure what that has to do with the GAC carve-out in any case. I just don't think that we had any ability to, we didn't have any, that was not within our mandate. In any way, shape, or form that I was aware of.
Well, the relation comes into the fact that we have created a designator model which appoints directors. There is a legal responsibility and power of those designators to both appoint and remove those directors. We have been arguing over what form that approval and consent should take. I've been told from Matthew just now that we are not going to affect the board's power, even though designator model does so and goes to the heart of that, we're not going to affect the board's ability to remove another director because that is not specifically stated in the CCWG report. My connection here is that a number of people over the past couple of days have been making the argument that we need to reinterpret how the GAC carve-out is applied because it should not apply to certain decisions. We also had the suggestion earlier last week that the GAC carve-out should only apply about board decisions that are substantially based or solely based on GAC consensus advice. Neither of those terms appear in the CCWG report. And if we're going to be a stickler about what is and what is not applied in the bylaws as to whether it is referenced in the CCWG report or not, I think we should apply that standard absolutely, positively, equally across the board. Thank you.
Thanks, Brett. Let me just ask you a quick follow-up question. I have a hard time understanding what the connection between the carve-out, which relates to decisions that are made by the board, and removing board members by the board is.
I'm not applying the connection is between the removal of board members or the GAC carve-out, though theoretically some relation could apply if a GAC consensus decision to remove a board director was made and the board was not able to reject that. But that's not why I'm trying to say here. I'm trying to say that the argument that has been made that the failure or the unacceptability of requiring affirmative consent from the EC for the board to remove a director is unacceptable or out of bounds because no specific reference or recommendation to that was made in the CCWG proposal. If we're going to apply that strict standard, I believe that we should apply it equally across the entire CCWG report, and that other things that are not put into the report should also not be input into the bylaws. And the connection I'm being made here is one of principle, that if you're going to have a strict standard for one part of this report, then you should have a strict standard for the other parts of this report, and that arguments that have been made over the last week in terms of trying to reinterpret or weaken the GAC carve-out should be considered out of bounds because no such caveat was included in the CCWG report. Am I clear on that? I'm trying to explain my connection here.
That's well understood now. So I understand that you don't have an issue with this answer to question six. You have an issue with the carve-out as such. We're going to discuss the carve-out at a later point during this call, and therefore let's try
that's,
to move
that's
on.
That's not precisely Kavusha, correct. I do have an issue with this, but I've been told that my issue is irrelevant because it's not contained in the CCWG report. And if that standard is going to apply, I hope it is applied equally. That's my objection.
Okay, fair enough, Brett. Good. Kavus, if you want to talk about the carve-out, I don't want to discuss the carve-out now. We've just settled that we can leave the answer to question six as it is. Please not be sidetracked by the carve-out question now.
I'm not talking about carve-out. Why this gentleman just talk about the carve-out? We are not dealing with the carve-out. The anti-GAC sentiment or GAC phobia sentiment expressed by some people has nothing to do with this question. They want to the GAC carve out later on when we reach that. I don't think the comment was totally irrelevant and rejected, poisoning and preparing a ground for something else. Biasing the views of the people. We are not discussing the carve-out, Thomas. Please don't allow the people to talk about the carve-out. What is the carve-out here? Nothing.
And Kavus, thank you very much. Alan, you haven't spoken, so I'll let you know. Please.
Thank you very much. If we had drafted the report with
complete preciseness and no omissions, we wouldn't be here today having these discussions. We are because the lawyers have identified things where they need clarity or they need some refinement to draft the bylaws. I believe we have to handle each of them on their own merits and do our best job in each one. That's the only possible way proceeding forward. Applying a single rule just does not apply because they each of the issues we're looking at have different merits and different issues. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Alan. And actually, you stole my thunder because that would have been my conclusion as we move to the next question. Certainly, we have our report. We are conducting these meetings in order to ensure that the implementation of our report is in the spirit of our deliberations, and therefore we have to reflect on what the group's deliberations were. And I do have memory of discussions about the carve-out and words like solely based on and others. So there is some substance that we can go back to, while we've never made an attempt to change the board procedure for removing board members. But let's now move to the next slide, and that is question number 33, plus additional question number 5, and that deals with mediation community IRP. We have received, or we've asked for the question to be redrafted. We have received feedback from the lawyers. There has been some uncertainty in the leadership team as to how to deal with these additional qualifications, and I would like to hand over to Becky at this stage to guide us through that.
Yeah, I'm sorry I'm in a noisy place, but I'll try to be clear. I think we have to go back to the lawyers again. I am confused because I think that the mediation issue arises as part of an independent review process. In other words, once you decide to go to bring an independent review, you go to mediation first. And I think the GAC carve-out applies wherever the GAC carve-out applies, which is to say if the issue being either that it's the subject of an independent review or being mediated was the product of the board's implementation of GAC advice, then the carve-out applies. So I don't think the lawyers have quite answered our question. And I also don't understand what the PDP issue, how that arises in this context.
Okay, so we are waiting for further clarification from the lawyer. There was one additional question by the group, and that was whether the escalation procedure should automatically lead to mediation. Is that something that we can settle on today, Becky?
I think that that the way the IRP is drafted is that once you invoke IRP, you would go to something called constructive, and you would have the ability to go into a formal constructive engagement or to flip it into mediation. So again, I don't think we can resolve it. I think I need to have a conversation with the lawyers to understand what they were attempting to clarify.
Okay, thanks, Becky. I saw that Holly's hand was raised. In the meantime, Holly, did you wish to speak?
Yeah, I think why don't I try to have a call with Becky and clarify it. I think generally that if we have a principle that says if the underlying matter is subject to the GAC carve-out, the procedures are met, are subject to the same carve-out, it's a fine principle. So I just want to make sure we're all on the same page. So
on that principle, I don't think there's any doubt.
Okay.
You know, if...
So Becky, let me just, if that principle's okay, let me just go back and make sure that I understand what the question was, because it's been a few days since we looked at it, and make sure that there was no other question embedded in it, but I think we're good for the moment, because I understand the principle that you're giving us.
Great. So I would suggest that you sort it out, take it offline, and get back to the group with any outcome of your discussion. And I mentioned earlier, and I should have spoken to that, that we haven't yet received an answer on a specific issue that we had asked the lawyers about. That looks like, you know, you were not delivering. And let me just go on record that the opposite is the case. You guys are superstars in this phase. You know, the workload that you've taken and the quality of the work is just outstanding. So let me join those, again, that have a priority for all your hard work and for the excellent support, all the folks that have been working in your team. So please convey that to your colleagues as well.
So, thank you so much. The legal team appreciates that. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Let's now move to the next slide, and Jan is going to guide you through the next couple of slides.
Thank you very much, Thomas. So can we please move to slide number 9? These are uncontested comments, and I might have a little bit of background noise, so my apologies for that. And the first additional question is on the selection of IRP panel. And indeed, we have signaled that the lawyers shall ensure that the process is in consultation with the community and is not strong enough. So also, the selection process must be truly community-driven, and the role of the board is only to confirm or veto proposed panels. This seems to be uncontested. So if there are no comments or questions on this issue, we could, of course, provide the lawyers with this very clear guidance so they can do their work. I see that Farsani is asking what is the procedure for mediator selection, and this is something that I believe that the lawyers will, of course, develop through the drafting of the pilot. So
IRP working group is developing that.
Thanks, Peggy. Could you please repeat that?
The IRP working group will develop that.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. So that's work in progress for Sunny, and of course, when we have more clarity on how this will happen, we will come back to Okay, so can we go to the next slide, please? So the next slide is on the IRP rules of procedures. And here, the lawyers... Yes?
Leon?
Yes, Becky?
I'm going through security, so I need to drop now for a few minutes, so maybe you want to go on to the other one.
I'm sorry, Becky, I couldn't hear you well.
I am going through airport security now, so I wonder if you want to postpone this and come back to it later.
Okay, yes, we'll definitely skip this question and come back when you have gone through airport security. So can we please turn to the next slide? And these are questions from our group. The additional question number 8 on PICs. Jorge Rose's question, why PICs are not mentioned in section 1.1b4. And here the lawyers will respond to Jorge, unless Jorge confirms that the answer given on April 5 was satisfactory. And I'm not sure if we have Jorge on this call, but if we do, yes, we do have Jorge. So Jorge, could you please confirm whether okay, so he's signaling that he would appreciate a response by the lawyers. So we'll ask the lawyers to kindly respond to Jorge's question, not at this point, but of course on the list. So can we move to, I think that we have run out of uncontested topics at this point, but we nevertheless need to go back to the question on IRP rules and procedures, but I'm not sure if Becky has already crossed airport security. So if we may, we could go back to Thomas for the next slides. And I see Tijani's hand is up. I'm sorry, Thomas. I just saw Tijani's hand is up. So Tijani, would you like to make some comments? Tijani, might you be on mute? We cannot hear you.
Yes. Yes, Leon. Do you hear me now? You hear me?
Yes, okay. We do hear you now.
Thank you very much. As for the IRP, I thought that we have a group that has to address the IRP issues. That's why I didn't raise any point. But I have at least two important points to address as for the rule of procedure of the IRP and also about the consideration period. So tell me if we have to speak about that here now or if we have to address it in the group related to the IRPs.
Thanks, Tijani. I think that the right place to raise these issues would be with the IRP working group. So, I am waiting for Becky to cross airport security. So if we could please wait for her to be back, and then we could, of course, raise any issues, taking the advantage that we're all here already. So if you kindly could wait for Becky to signal us when she comes back, we'll go back to this point. And, of course, any issues that you need to raise will be welcome at this point.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Tijani. Now I'm going back to Thomas. Thomas?
Thanks very much, Leon. And just a quick note to Tijani. The IRP working group will discuss details of the IRP. So if you want to chime in when it comes to the rules of procedure that this group will develop, then certainly this group will be the right place to make those comments. We need all the comments that this group might have with respect to the bylaw drafting, and ideally we would have them already. As you know, we had discussed and set a deadline 2359 on the 9th of April. So when it comes to what's in the current draft bylaws, by all means, please do speak up so that we have a comprehensive view of the group's comments on this. I'm not even sure whether we need Becky to come back on the question that you find on slide 10. I think we need to get back to Becky when it comes to IRP or other IRP questions. This one maybe we can do very quickly. It basically just says that the current bylaws state that the panelists themselves can discuss and agree on changes to the rules of procedure. And I think you will agree with me that changes to the rules of procedure should not be decided upon by the panelists, but that should be a community process. And therefore, our proposed answer is that the community-driven nature of the establishment of the rules of procedure should be reinforced in the bylaws, i.e. no decision-making on the rules of procedure by the panelists themselves. Is there any opposition to that? Greg.
No opposition per se, but I think it is appropriate for the panelists to have a place in the process and possibly the ability to at least initiate suggested changes in the rules of procedure. But in the end, I support 100% that approval of any changes should be a community-driven process, and that the ability to initiate that should also be shared with the community. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Greg. And if as if Cavus had read your mind, he has made a comment along the same line. So I would suggest that we take note of your additional comment and the comment that has already been made by Cavus, that rules of procedure changes can be discussed and proposed by the panelists, but the ultimate decision should be made by the community after public consultation process. So thanks very much for that. I think with that we can move on. So can we please go to the next slide? We need to go to slide number 13, actually. Can we check if Becky is back with us? Because these are a lot of questions on the reconsideration process and the IRP. Becky, are you back with us?
I am back.
Excellent. So what you see on this slide looks quite frightening because there are a lot of words and a lot of figures on it, but this is basically the extract of the questions that relate to the reconsideration process as well as to the IRP from the 18-page document. So the first question to be answered is whether, and that's a question that was raised by David McAuley, whether the RR and the IRP should be available for human rights-related concerns or complaints before the FOI is adopted. So, Becky, would you like to suggest an answer to that?
So my understanding is that the report was clear that cases relating to the bylaws change that would include a commitment to human rights would not be that would not be right, brought to an reconsideration or IRP before the framework of interpretation was in place.
Tijani's hand is up. Tijani, you would like to comment on this? Tijani, you might be on mute, and I see that David just says that his question has not been adequately presented, so we'll get back to that momentarily.
Yes, Thomas. I would like to say that if you read the bylaws proposal, it says very clearly that nothing will be applicable for the human rights before the adoption of the FOI. So I think the response for this question is no. Thank you.
So that seems to be in line with what's been mentioned by David and supported by Tatiana. So Ed and Tatiana's hands are up. If you have raised your hand to confirm this, you may pass. Ed?
Yeah, thanks, Thomas. The problem I have is that some of us would argue that ICON already has human rights obligations under Article 4 of the Association. And that's been confirmed by the Dr. Pouvet's decision, where due process was stated to be imputed into ICON's obligation to respect international law and international agreements under Article 4. So the question I have is, can we word this in a way that says that specific human rights obligations as a result of what we're doing in the framework of interpretation cannot be relied upon in appeals to IRPs, but allow us to maintain those rights that we technically already have under the Articles of Association? I don't think it's the intent of anyone to lessen ICON's obligation to respect human rights through the Workstream 2 process, but if we're going to say you can't rely upon human rights right now, that's actually what we're doing in the interim period. I don't think that's right.
Thanks very much, Ed. We have Holly and Rosemary on the call. I'm not sure whether they are the right ones in their teams to respond to this, but actually you're asking a new question, so let's capture that and try to get an answer. Tatiana.
Thanks a lot. Tatiana Tropina is speaking for the record. I kind of agree with Ed, but the point of that we discussed Article 4 of Articles of Incorporation at the Working Party Forum on Human Rights. And of course, many of us told that Article 4 actually includes obligation to respect human rights. But some of the members of the Working Party 4 told that then we will need individual and independent legal assessment of this Section 4, which refers to the international law and standards. And this means that the process would be quite lengthy. And I believe that in this case, the prohibition of reviews and requests before the framework of interpretation will be implemented does not actually include the application of the Articles of Incorporation. There are not exclusive things. So I believe that we are not creating any conflicts here. When we are referring to specific human rights obligation to respect human rights, of course, we need framework of implementation. But if someone wants to challenge the fact that ICANN is not following some international standards or whatever, of course, they can do it under the Article 4, the Article of Incorporation. I don't see any conflicts here. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Tatiana. We have Cavus and David, and then I'd like to end the queue. Cavus, we can't hear you.
Consistent with what we have written, that everything is subject to the approval of this FOI, perhaps we should say something notwithstanding the present either practice or present articles or something that we are not going that whatever they're doing for years, they should forget about that and waiting for FOI. Perhaps we should try to at least, I would say, implicitly grandfather what they have these days, they're respecting to. So we add something at the beginning to explain that. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Cavus. David?
Thank you, Thomas. My apologies. It took me a while to dial in, but I just wanted to make a statement that I think the question misunderstood my comment, and so I probably wasn't as clear as I should have been. My comment was that in Annex 6, there's bylaws text, which basically prohibits claims, and then there's explanatory text, which has an implication, and so it's only an implication, that HR, human rights claims, would be viable at IRP after the framework of interpretation. My point is that whether human rights claims are a proper subject for IRP itself, that fundamental question is itself an issue for the FOI to determine. I think there are a number of reasons why that should not be the case. Courts are better able to handle it. It's a complex matter. But there are other points, both pro and con. Ed and Niels came on list over the weekend, and I respect their points of view, and they have positions con. I think it should be a full-throated debate in WS Workstream 2, though, and that was my point. I think giving bylaws language to an implication in this respect, where this particular implication wasn't debated very much in the HR subgroup of which I was a part or the CCWG, would be a mistake. So thank you, Thomas, for this opportunity to speak.
Thanks, David, and I apologize for not having reflected your question adequately here. That's certainly my fault. I think you've been very clear. I had closed the queue, but I see that Niels and Greg want to speak to this reframed or now finally correctly displayed question from David. So let's hear the two of them. I would like to ask you to be brief so because we have a lot of more questions on our plate. Niels?
I guess then I will start and I'll be brief. Thank you very much, Thomas. I'm a bit surprised by David's remarks, especially because it has been discussed extensively in the preparation in Working Party 4 and also in the CCWG at large. I do not think we should reopen it. The text, as I mentioned also during the last call, makes it really clear that ICANN does not have the obligation to protect but to respect human rights. So when we make a commitment in the framework of interpretation, then that should definitely be under the process, be possible to get challenged under an IRP, because else it doesn't really make any sense to make a commitment at all. And I think we have reached consensus on this, and I think reopening the negotiations on this moment, on this point, would be unwise. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Neil. Greg?
Thanks. A couple of points, Greg Shatton. I'll try to make them quickly. First, I think we shouldn't confuse human rights conceptually with the human rights bylaw specifically. The human rights bylaw, as we all know, will be essentially not effective until the framework of interpretation is completed and adopted. So, you know, at this point, it can't be relied on for a bylaws-related IRP claim. That's not to say that if somebody wants to find or try to find a human rights issue under other standards and sections of the bylaws or the articles, that they would be stopped from doing that. We're not trying to take away any claims that could be made today. Whether due process is identified merely as a human right or as a rule of law issue or other things, you know, is kind of beside the point. I think about due process in the legal context without needing to, you know, go to the issue of human rights. So I think the point here is that, you know, an IRP, you know, can't be based on a bylaw that's not yet effective. But other than that, current standards, you know, should be unchanged. And when we get to the end of Workstream 2 and the end of getting the framework of an interpretation in place, you know, I think by that time we will have already also had a robust discussion about issues like this related to the bylaw once it is effective. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Greg. And I understand that Mathieu would like to chime in on this.
Thank you, Thomas, and hello, everyone. This is Mathieu Vey speaking. This is just to read what I think was the core recommendation of the Annex 6 of our supplemental report. It's paragraph 23, which states that within its core values, ICANN will commit to respect internationally recognized human rights as required by applicable law. This provision does not create any additional obligation for ICANN to respond to or consider any complaint, request, or demand seeking the enforcement of human rights by ICANN. And this bylaw provision will not enter into force until the FOI is developed and the FOI is approved by the ICANN board. I think that is what drove us towards the suggestion that Thomas described and not putting it as a transitional article at this point. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mathieu. With that, I'd like to move on to the next question. So, Tatiana, I guess that's an old hand. Caboose, I had closed the conversation on this. Is there any new aspect on this?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I'm seconding. But the question is that the FOI issue was raised because ICANN did not want that anyone invoke IRP, that ICANN has not implemented the human rights, but whatever they're doing today is valid and should be continued. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Kaboot. Let's then move to the next question, which related to Andrew. We had an exclusion of the applicability of the IRP for resources for protocol parameters in the draft bylaws, and Andrew suggested that it should be disputes relating to protocol parameters. So he was not sure what resources for protocol parameters would mean in this sense, or he would prefer to have disputes relating to protocol parameters excluded from the applicability of the IRP. This is because the IETF has its own appeals mechanism for these cases. So I would suggest that we go with Andrew's recommendation on this unless we hear from anyone in the group disputing this. You can get back on this while you're thinking about it, but let me just introduce the next question, which was the that the definition of staff was felt to be ambiguous. I guess that's also a comment made by Andrew. The bylaws read that those that are grieved by a board or a staff action can use the IRP, and that was ambiguous. I understand, Becky, that there has been some work on that. Becky, can I ask you to help us with this?
Yes, and I believe that Holly and Rosemary have arrived at some language for clearing up that ambiguity in another section. So that could just be transported here.
Awesome. So let's tick that off the list as well. Becky, would you like to speak to the next point as well regarding cost shifting?
Yes, I think that Andrew's correct. We should add the paragraph R.
Okay, so so that seems to be a drafting glitch. Malcolm's hand is up. Malcolm, welcome.
Just a quick clarification on the staff issue. IRP cases aren't cases brought against the board. They're cases brought against ICANN for ICANN having acted out in a way that's contrary to the bylaws. So whether that's done by normally it would be the board that would have the opportunity to do that, but if there is a case that shows that the staff have acted in a way that's inconsistent with bylaws and that the board ought to have restrained, then the IRP action would lie in the case of that. It is the mechanism is there against the company, not against a part of the company.
That's correct, Malcolm.
Thanks for that clarification, which we have on record now, so that's helpful. Then there was a question whether decisions shall be suspended pending resolution. I guess that was a point mentioned by Brett. Becky?
Do we have provided, but we specifically provided for injunctive relief in specified circumstances for the IRP.
Thanks, Becky. So it looks like, Brett, there is a provision on that. You would still like to comment on that, so the floor is yours.
Very briefly. What I noticed in there that there was relief offered in the case where the EC was doing an IRP, but it wasn't clear to me where that was also provided for individuals or actions less than the EC. And this isn't so much of a argument, but just a question of where that is, and should it be made clear that that is the case?
Well, so it was definitely should apply to both, and we'll ask the lawyers to go back and make sure it's clear that it applies to both.
So let's just make sure that in the notes and certify that for the lawyers, as well as the other issues that we've identified here, it should apply to both.
One other clarification was that it not only applies to the IRP, but to the request for reconsideration as well. That was also unclear to me. We can provide clarification on either or both.
So there's no, mechanism in the request for reconsideration other than for asking the board to stay its decision. So the proposal doesn't contain the possibility of injunctive relief unless the committee considering the reconsideration request decides that it makes sense to do it.
It seems to me that potential damage could result from a board decision, even in the situation for a request for reconsideration, and there's no provision currently there to allow for a decision to be pending until that request is resolved. And should there
I think it's an interesting question. It is not something that was contemplated in the report at all. And it doesn't currently exist. I mean, we expressly talked about restraining order or injunctive relief in the context of the IRP. We didn't discuss it at all in the context of reconsideration. So that would be a change from the report and some current practices.
Thanks, Becky and Brett. So it looks like the report does speak to suspending decisions for the IRP, but the report has been silent on reconsideration requests. Cavus?
Thomas, are you discussing the last but one indent, please?
We are now discussing the third but last question. Shall decisions be suspended pending resolution? And we're
okay,
now
I have
moving...
no comment. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you, Cavus. We're now moving to the question whether court action can be started by the empowered community or by everyone. So, Becky, you wanted to speak to that too, right?
Whether what can be started? I'm sorry.
Can anyone or just the empowered community start a court action to enforce an IRP decision if the board rejects, should that be made clear?
Anyone who is a party to the arbitration can commence board action to enforce the arbitration. That will be clear from the rules of the arbitration, and I think it's clear in the report.
So I guess that was a question from Brett. Brett, does that answer the question sufficiently so that we can take it off the list?
Yes, I think that I just wanted to make sure that anybody could take a court action. The only place that it's specifically stated is in the EC section. Again, it wasn't stated in the IRP section, at least not that I saw. So as long as that everybody has that option, then that and that is made clear, then that's fine.
So we should just note that for the lawyers.
Becky, can you please repeat that last sentence?
We should just ask the lawyers to make sure that it's clear in both cases.
We've got
yes.
it, Becky.
And I see that it's currently being written into the notes. So that's good. Cavus, you had a comment?
Yes. I think the essence of this question is that if we say anyone could start a court, means that it could bypass the EC. Anyone could start that, but through the EC. Why could totally bypass the EC? What is the usefulness of the community power if everyone could go to take the court directly? So the issue is this. I don't know whether that was answered or not. Thank you.
Cavus, I guess you've misheard this. Any party to an IRP can start a court action, so it's not everyone who wishes to bypass the empowered community. We can now move to the last bullet point. That's the point, Becky, that you've asked me to add to the slide with respect to the need to refine language regarding the interplay of arbitration provisions in the registry and registrar agreements.
Yes, so there's just a funny drafting glitch, which I think could be cleared up very easily. The registrars and registries have binding arbitration provisions in their agreements. Those binding arbitration clauses should be used for a dispute related to, you know, contractual disputes, interpretations, and the like. It's only bylaws issues that can be pursued through an IRP. It almost looks like registries and registrars couldn't bring IRP claims about violations of the bylaws, and that wasn't really intended to be the case. So it's just a clarification that needs to be made to ensure that registries and registrars have the same rights as other parties who are materially affected by ICANN's actions.
Thanks very much, Becky. I trust that this request is uncontroversial. If there are issues with this, please put yourself in the queue or make a comment in the chat. Brett, I guess that was an old hand, so we can move to Tijani now.
Thank you very much, Thomas. I would like to add another point, which is Section 4.3, Paragraph S. An IRP panel should complete its an IRP proceeding expeditiously in issuing an early scheduling order and its written decision no later than 6 months after the filing of the claim, unless that is not reasonably possible under the circumstances. This unless make it open, and an IRP might last 3 years if we don't make a limitation. When we discussed this point in the CCWG, I was told by Becky and the others that this issue would be in the rule of procedure, and we will discuss it in the rule of procedure. I do think that it must be in the rule of procedure and not in the bylaws, and I hope that we can discuss it deeply and make it the 6 months might be extended for another period, but we must have a hard stop so that the IRP will not be an endless process which will open the area for any gaming, et cetera, et cetera. Thank you.
So let me just respond, Thomas, that we will definitely address this issue in the IRP implementation.
Okay, so that seems to...
I didn't hear Becky.
Becky was saying that this is an issue that will be covered by the IRP group.
So it will not be in the bylaw like that. Okay, thank you.
So, Becky, can we ask for your confirmation? Tijani said that...
I believe that the bylaws language that will say what, you know, that it's 6 months unless that's not possible, and then the IRP group will say what happens when that is not possible and how you determine whether it's not possible. But I believe that the bylaws as currently written faithfully reproduces the report.
So let me try to...
If it is like this, please, can you change the wording unless that is not reasonably possible and that will be addressed in the rule of procedure or something like this?
Tijani, I would suggest that we defer to the lawyers to find the right words for this, but let me try to capture this so that notes can be adequately taken. The bylaws language will need to leave a door open in case there are circumstances that don't make it possible to conclude the case or to end the case in 6 months. But the details of under what circumstances this extension can be used will be specified in the rules of procedure to be worked on by the IRP working group. So if it's appropriate for the lawyers to make reference or if it is required to make a particular reference to the terms of procedure, then the lawyer should be doing that. If it is unusual to do that or not required, then I suggest we trust the lawyer's advice in that instance as well. So thanks, everyone, for, you know, this has been a challenging slide. I promise this has been the most challenging slide in the slide deck. So you will see that there are less words on the next slide. And I'd like to add a step to move us to that one. And that is with respect to the carve-out. So you might be slightly disappointed that this is not so wordy, but actually we have asked the lawyers to reword the carve-out to more adequately reflect the essence of the report. So we should wait for the revised language, but for those who want to speak to the carve-out, let us make this instruction to the lawyers very clear, that the lawyers are requested to ensure that the applicability of the carve-out is not broadened. I guess that has been a concern, that the carve-out is excessively used in places where it shouldn't belong and that the role of government should be marginalized. And certainly that is not the intention of our drafting exercise, but we want to ensure that the carve-out is implemented and operationalized in the way we had it in our report. Tijani, I guess that was an old hand. Tavuz, your hand is raised.
You said that the lawyers are invited to propose a language for carve-out. I think the language for the carve-out is in the report. They need not to be reworded. Toward the end of the discussions in CCWD call 82 or 83, one GNSO colleague talked about the innovation. Another person came with the carve-out, and the sentence which is already in the document that was proposed said that if the community objects the ICANN decision, ICANN board decision, on the GAC consensus advice on the ground that it is not consistent with the mission of bylaw, then in the process of the community power, GAC cannot participate. That's all. So it should not be extended to anything beyond that. We should not use this session of the discussion to the lawyers about the drafting of the bylaw to try to make a règlement de compte for issue that was not succeeded in the CCWG and try to just put it here. The exact wording is in the text recommendation 1 and 2, and nothing should be added to that. And I wonder why we need to have multiple provisions in the bylaw dealing with that. We just need to make reference or cut and paste those which are already in the recommendation 1 and 2. That's all. And I gave one example to you last night or night before. The change of the fundamental bylaw is not made by community, is not as a result of the GAC consensus advice. The only entity is ICANN. We change that, but it's up to community to approve that or not to approve that. That's all. But I don't think that initiation of change of the bylaw by the fundamental bylaw has any relevance to the GAC consensus advice. No community, no entity involved in that, because it was mentioned in the report that for that particular thing is only ICANN proposed changes. Community just approved or not approved that. So all of those provisions relating to that and saying that if the modification to the fundamental bylaw is as a result of the GAC consensus advice, there is no GAC consensus advice. There is no possibility of that. This has been extended and pervaded all through the reports. So why we need to do that? And you?
If that's a-
So you mentioned and you committed that you maintain what is in the recommendations, not one word or one letter more, and not one or letter or one comma less. That is that. Exactly, we should cut and paste and repeat that, but not try to pervade that and having a dozen of provisions and trying to extend that to the area which is totally unacceptable, like modification to fundamental bylaw. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Kavuz. And just to be perfectly clear, I think our group needs to rely at least to a huge extent on the expertise of those that are drafting the bylaws. So they are working on the language. All the concerns that have been raised by both yourself as well as Brett to look at the other side of the spectrum, those who are concerned about either broadening or narrowing the applicability of the carve-out have been heard, and I would suggest that we wait for revised language to be presented to the group. You mentioned that it only needs to be referenced to once. I'm sure that the drafters have heard that encouragement to keep it very simple. Whether or not that is possible, I cannot tell. But I think we should await the revised language and then look at whether it truly and accurately reflects the spirit of our report. So thanks very much for that. Let's move to the next slide, please. That is on mission and regulation. That was question number 12, or a number of questions asked by Malcolm. There has been an exchange of thoughts on that already. So rather than filling the slides with a lot of words, let us check whether the answers offered by Becky have sufficiently answered Malcolm's concerns. Malcolm, you're on the call, so you might want to speak to this.
Thomas.
Becky.
I'm sorry, this is Becky. I think that my answer did not satisfy Malcolm. I think that was quite clear. And we've asked attorneys to go back and look at this particular issue. I submitted a couple of suggested languages, but I don't think it's worth asking whether my answer satisfied Malcolm, because I think it's clear they did not.
Okay, I see Bradley's hand is raised. Nonetheless, I would like to give Malcolm the opportunity to speak.
Okay, well, Becky's reply actually acknowledged the point that I was making, and I take it that that is why she's now referred it back to the lawyers. It seemed to be implicit within what she'd written that actually she thought that answer would be sufficient so that there wouldn't need to be a change, whereas I read what she was writing as being an acceptance that there did need to be a change. Since she has now, following the further conversation that's going on, said, yes, okay, we will take this back and we will have a look at ensuring that this more fully implements the full scope of what the report said. I'm very satisfied with that. That was what I was looking for as a commitment from this call. So I will be happy with what Becky has just said and look forward to reading what the lawyers come up with next.
Great. Thanks so much. Bradley, Milton, and then Greg.
Thanks. This is Bradley. So I'm also in agreement that, you know, it would be acceptable to move forward and wait for a response from the lawyers as to how we might better reflect what was in the report. And I guess I just wanted to clarify that, you know, of course, none of us wants to go back and reopen that question about, you know, what we were trying to get at. But, you know, I would just caution us not trying to specifically describe one of the means by which the imposition of regulations may take place, but rather more faithfully reflect or what we meant by the word regulation, since that just seemed to be the only question that's in play here.
Thanks, Bradley. Milton?
Yes. I understand that the problem we run into here is that the lawyers did not like the word regulate and thought that it had antitrust implications, and I'm wondering if Becky could explain to me what those are. I don't know how it might be construed to create some kind of competition policy problem, but I think that that issue is actually not all that credible, but I'm, of course, willing to listen to the lawyers on that subject. But if we're getting into this problem simply because of the word regulate, I want to know how serious and substantial that problem is, or whether we can simply revert back to the word regulate or some word like control in its place.
So this is Becky. I am not an antitrust regulation expert, although I do have some experience. But all of the lawyers around the table in Los Angeles expressed a serious concern with the use of that word in terms of what kinds of exposure it created for ICANN in an antitrust setting. And this concern was enhanced by the fact that, of course, by withdrawing the U.S. Government contract, ICANN is exposed to more risk from antitrust scrutiny in any case. I am not qualified to speak to how serious a concern it was, although I can tell you it was a concern that all of the lawyers, including some antitrust experts around the table, felt was serious, and therefore we were trying to find a way to deal with it.
If I could just follow up real quickly, keep in mind that we're telling ICANN not to regulate in this provision. We're not telling them to regulate. We're specifically saying you shall not regulate, and we're not telling them the prices of domain names or anything like that. We're talking about content. So, again, I'm having trouble.
I hear you, but it is a highly complex area of legal specialty, and I am not going to overly simplify it by saying it's okay because we're not talking about prices. And I do think we have to refer to our legal experts with the appropriate expertise. But having said that, we've heard loud and clear the concerns of the community with the construct, and we are seeking to address that.
Thanks, Becky. Milton, I think we should try to get a satisfactory answer to at least the status of what we have now. So while we're hearing Greg, can I ask whether either Holly or Rosemary would like to speak to this and after that? Greg, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Greg Shatton, for the record. I'd be very interested to hear the answer from Holly and Rosemary. I actually did practice antitrust law for 12 years, but I'm not going to substitute my off-the-cuff judgment of what the judgment made in the room was when we have the people who are actually in the room discussing the antitrust concerns raised by the word regulation. Two quick points. Malcolm is not the only one. I'm sure you didn't intend to imply this, but Malcolm's not the only one who's concerned with getting this right. I think we all are. So satisfying Malcolm is not our only goal, and it's satisfying everyone, or at least reasonably. So I know that Malcolm was the one who kicked off the discussion, but I think we're all focused on getting this one right, and a number of us, if not all of us, have concerns, which may not be identically aligned, but in the end, trying to get to the something that makes everyone satisfied is where we should be going. So I'll shut up now and hope that I have my own idea of what they might have said about the antitrust regulation nexus, but I'll be interested to hear if it aligns with what was actually said. Thanks.
So let's do this, Greg. Let's hear from Holly and Rosemary, and you can reveal after they spoke whether what they say is in line with your 12-year long expertise in antitrust law. Would that be something? Let's hear either Holly or Rosemary. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but Holly has raised her hand, so please, Holly.
Sure, go ahead and put me on the spot on this one. Look, this is a really hard area of the bylaws, and one of the reasons it's difficult, I think, as Greg just said, while there's agreement that it needs to be addressed in some way, there's not, from what we can tell from the chat, whole alignment on what's trying to be accomplished here. So we've tried a number of times to come up with language. We've worked closely with Becky and ICANN Legal and others to try to address this, and clearly we still haven't hit it yet. We will go back and look at the word regulate and see if somehow that fixes all the problems. We had tried to avoid that term for the very antitrust issues that were raised, but that doesn't mean it absolutely cannot be used. And so we will take another look at it. If there is no way to get to the solution that you're looking for without using the word, I don't think any word is so precious that it cannot be used. So we'll go take another look. This one's a difficult one, and it's a struggle, and it's hard. It's a struggle because we're not sure that there is as much alignment on this as people think. That's all I've got.
Thanks very much, Holly. So I suggest that we wait for your further analysis, I would suggest that we pause this item for the time being, because I think we can't take this much further. Cavus, your hand was raised.
Yes, no problem to wait until Holly comes with some, but I don't agree with her saying that she wants to avoid the use of regulations. That is the essence of this provision. Shall not regulate. How she would like to avoid that, to put what word which is so clearly indicate that shall not regulate. That was discussed hours and hours, and I don't know what we are doing now. All of those discussions of 14 months are now in the hands of some few limited people to put it in the way that they believe it is right. But what happened to those things? This issue was discussed for hours. Shall not regulate. This regulate is necessary. It has a meaning. It has a connotation. So, Holly, please do not kindly avoid to use that word. Thank you.
Thanks, Cavus. Bradley?
Thanks. Sorry, I'll be brief. I think one of the things that helped us get to a point where we were able to reach agreement on what the specific word should be was actually moving away from the verb regulate to the words impose regulations, because that was much more specific action, a much more specific description of what ICANN would be doing and what we would want to prohibit them from doing. So, I certainly appreciate the questions around what regulate means, because that's what we all struggled with when we went through this discussion. And, I'd hope that by moving away from acting as a regulator to imposing regulations, we were much clearer on what we wanted to see happen. So to the extent that's at all helpful in helping the lawyers move this forward, I just wanted to offer that.
Thanks very much, Bradley. I think we should leave it with the lawyers now. I trust that they found the various interventions that have been made useful to inform their discussions. I would suggest that we move on now to the next slide, number 16. And that was a question by Andrew, if I'm not mistaken. He mentioned that in various places in the report or in the bylaws, mentioning of the global internet community is made, but that term has not been defined. And we've been thinking about that a little bit, and I know that Jordan volunteers to offer a response to that, but I see that Andrew's hand is raised. So, Andrew, you get the first bite of the apple, and after that we're going to hear from Jordan.
I promise not to take two bites of the apple. The other suggestion that I had is that the places where the global internet community is supposed to do something could instead be modified such that it just specifies who it is that's supposed to do something. And actually, the more I thought about this, the more attractive that seems, because whatever we come up with as a definition of the global internet community is bound to be contentious. So that might be an alternative. And I see that Cavus is saying the audio is distorted, so I apologize if that wasn't clear. If it wasn't clear, let me know, and I'll type it in the chat.
Okay, thanks very much, Andrew. And just to be clear, if you put yourself in the queue again to try to take a second bite, we're going to define an Andrew Sullivan carve-out. Next is Jordan.
Thanks, Thomas. I think I'm agreeing with Andrew, actually, but I'm just trying to imagine an Andrew carve-out at the moment. We don't need to define the global internet community if we just say the global internet community working through ICANN structures and providing comments through ICANN's public participation processes. So we just, this is all dealing with things that happen within the ICANN framework. So if we just say it's whoever chooses to participate in the ICANN framework, I think that will work fine for us. That was my only suggestion.
That looks like good guidance. Maybe we can ask the lawyers to draft something along these lines. Cavus, your hand is raised.
This term, global internet community, is in the report. I have seen many reference to global multi-stakeholder community, but global internet community, what does it mean, global internet community? I hope that we should not invent something. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Cavus. I think we have found a solution to that, the support for the idea presented by Andrew and supported by Jordan. Malcolm.
Very short point, actually. Agreeing with Cavus, I support Jordan's proposed suggestion, but when it's implemented, it may be that we should treat global internet community as actually having been an editorial mistake. We should have read global multi-stakeholder community, which we have read used very many times. If I'm wrong there, please just ignore this, but I just throw that as a suggestion.
Malcolm, we would never ignore your comments. Let's actually give that some thought to make reference to the global multi-stakeholder community. There seems to be some, actually, I don't know in what sequence the chat comments came in.
But for implementing it, I would support Jordan's suggested approach.
Okay.
The global multi-stakeholder community acting through blah, 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 as Jordan said.
Good. Okay. So that looks great. Let's move to the next slide then. That's another point made by Andrew, and that related to mentioning of both the IETF as well as the IAB in the report, and Andrew found that not a great concern, but suggest that we drop either, and he said that the IAB is easier to consult with in order to smoothen out that language. So he just typed into the chat that he's not caring too much about this. So I would suggest that we try to, or that we will actually drop the IAB for the sake of getting this tidied up. And shouldn't we be able to get feedback on time, then we will leave the inconsistency in there. Cavus, your hand is raised again.
No, sorry, old hand, I'm sorry.
No worries. Good. So question 19 seems to be uncontroversial, and nobody seems to be willing to speak to that. That we should be close to the end of the slide deck. Do we have one more? Okay, so then we have a point which, if memory fails, unless memory fails me, has been brought up by Brett, and that was a question of whether the current SOAC structure should be made a fundamental bylaw. So, Jordan, I think you wanted to speak to that, right?
Briefly, the question about whether the composition should or otherwise, when we were doing the list in Work Party 1 of what should be fundamental bylaws and what shouldn't, we were trying to juggle the kind of core framework, the constitutional settlement, if you like, of this new structure into fundamental bylaws, and leave as much as possible of the detail as non-fundamental. So we didn't think that less critical issues needed to be defined as fundamental bylaws. We wanted to keep the scope of them as limited as possible. And so the internal construction of the SOs and ACs, or the question of new SOs or ACs, generally speaking, was felt to be outside that scope. where the fundamental bylaws do and should regulate it is whether those SOs and AFCs participate as decisional participants in the empowered community with its new powers. So I don't know if Brett wants to know more about what the composition point meant, but if my understanding is, what are the SOs and AFCs, how are they composed internally, and what are their rules in general, and what Party One did consider that and didn't think it was appropriate for them to be fundamental?
Well, if I may speak on this, Matthew?
Well, it's Thomas.
But
you're most welcome to speak.
I wanted just to bring this to attention because it seemed to me that under the current bylaws, the board could vote to eliminate, say, ALAC or the GAC or the GNSO or the CCNSO, and unless the community specifically rejected that, then that could happen. And I didn't know if this is something that is objectionable necessarily, but I wanted to make sure that people were aware of, well, if that was indeed the case, whether that people were aware of that and found it to be acceptable. And if not, that there was an opportunity to address that in this discussion. If they thought it needed to be a fundamental bylaw where the community would actually have to affirmatively say that that change was acceptable. And this is just a point I wanted to bring up for discussion because that is the way I read it, and if I read it incorrectly, I apologize.
Thanks very much, Brett. And don't you worry about mistaking me for Mathieu. I think that's a privilege. I see there's a queue forming. And we only have 18 minutes, 17 minutes to the end of the to the top of the hour. I think we have presented an exhaustive list of what should be fundamental bylaws with our reports. So I would have concerns to add to that list of fundamental lists, which we have promised to be finite. Certainly, the point that you've made, Brett, is an important one, but I do have concerns that to change those on the fly during the implementation phase. Alan, Cavu, Sebastian, and after that we will close the queue.
Thank you very much. I would certainly consider it a major problem if the board could simply decide to eliminate the ALAC or the GNSO for that matter. However, if they did that, there would be a conflict within the bylaws because that organization would be mentioned in the fundamental bylaw defining the empowered community, but would not be defined elsewhere. And that alone, I think, is going to stop them from doing that because that would end up with a very significant inconsistency within the bylaws. I would have no problem if somewhere along the way it said that the board cannot eliminate ACs and SOs without and put that inside a fundamental bylaw, but I would object very strongly if the details outlining how the group works and all of the other part that is in each bylaw associated with the ACNSO were made a fundamental bylaw. Those are the parts of the bylaws that perhaps change the most often and need to change the most often, and we certainly would not want to make those fundamental bylaws. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Alan. Cavus?
Sorry, the previous question, Jordan kindly proposed something and all of a sudden everybody agrees and Holly asked where they put it. So I don't think that they'll address the situation. It mixed up between the global multi-stakeholder community and the global internet community. We don't agree with that. It is open and we have to find out what is the best way for that. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Cavus. Sebastian?
Yes, thank you, Sebastian Bachelet. Just very short, it's a discussion about going to the fundamental bylaws. The current composition of SO and AC shows that this bylaw are really very complicated, and it will be very difficult to move ICANN to a new structure. And then we need to put as less as possible regarding the organization of ICANN in the fundamental bylaw. We need to leave as much as possible flexibility. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Sebastian. The next point on the slide is that there is a copy and paste glitch at the end of 25.2. 3E and F, where reference to standard bylaws is made and it should be fundamental bylaws. So we asked the drafters to check that, to rectify if need be. I think that is the last slide, actually. Some of the questions mentioned by Brett regarding Annex D, that's page 18 of the document, have been referenced to another place. So I think we've covered everything, at least I do hope so. And that's good news. So we only have, I think, two questions where we are, where we need additional input from the lawyers, which we will take back to the group so that we can close the issues. At this point, I would like to thank everyone for a very constructive discussion. I think we've made great progress during this call, and I would like to hand over to Mathieu now.
Thank you very much, Thomas, and thank you for sharing along with Leon a lot of this part of the call, which was obviously the core of this meeting. In terms of next steps, considering the great progress we've made today, and that, as Thomas was saying, we only have a few questions, we can hope that the meeting that we have scheduled for tomorrow at 12 UTC could be a short one. It could be useful to, of course, confirm and ensure we have clarity, and then we enable us to submit to the lawyers clarified responses and comments by the agreed 13th of April deadline. That's the short-term steps. Once that's done, I think the question will be in the lawyers' hand and in the board's hand about whether they feel they're in a position to confirm the launch of the public comment by April 20th, and whether a new version of the bylaws we will have an opportunity to review any new version of that beforehand, but that's certainly not a necessity. I don't know, Holly or Rosemary, if you want to provide an update on what you see as the next steps on your side so that everyone's aware. Holly?
I think I need to confer with Rosemary. We clearly have a lot of work to do, and I don't want to promise a time for turnaround because we also need to get input from the ICANN lawyers. So we are going to go back into the cave and start revising and drafting and getting in a position to get this back out.
Thank you. Thank you, Holly. So I think as you can see that obviously we are everyone's working hard to meet the deadlines, but also needs to adjust to the amount of comment that we're receiving. So obviously this is going to be a little bit of some moving targets in the deadlines, and we need to remain flexible on that. But the short term is a meeting tomorrow, 12 UTC, and to close the final discussions. Caboos, I don't know if it's an old hand or a new hand.
New hand. I think I raised several questions about Annex D, and I raised the different colors. Greg was very kind and just clarified what the color means. But I had difficulty on the cut and paste of these colors. The green color has taken from somewhere. We don't know where it has been taken. We don't know the relevance of cut and pasting those green parts. The red part has been either something has been added from the CCWG proposal or added by the notion to the thinking of the lawyers. So we have lost total control of what is in Annex C. We don't know where it's come from. And I request that kindly they give the reference of this. Why, for instance, some of these green parts are coming and they're putting in particular part of Annex C, where it's come from, what is the relevance of that, and about the red one, we don't know. whatever is from the CCWG report, okay? If it is an expansion of that by interpretations or by legal definitions, no problem. But it is not clear, the red part, whether it is addition by the lawyer or it is addition from the CCWG. So I raised this in a very long message and unfortunately have not yet been replied. I kindly request our distinguished lawyer to look at that paper and provide information on that for clarity. Thank you.
Thank you, Kavus. I think Greg's answer was actually very correct in characterizing the colors of the text. And in terms of where the additional text was coming from, I would kindly refer you to the document that was circulated that was mapping the various recommendations with the various sections of our report. And once this has been checked, I think in respect to the work that's been done in actually producing this document, if there's anything outstanding, we should know. But, I mean, our respective reviews, I know you've been spending a considerable amount of time reviewing this. I think other colleagues have been as well. And these additions provided by the lawyers have been extremely useful to analyze this, and I hope you can agree with me that we should not overburden our lawyers at this point with additional requests. Is that a follow-up, Kavus?
Everybody, the explanation given in the reference document is not correct. I could not find any addition on that. And I send them email that in some of those things that for this section, please see this one for crosses. It is not consistent. So it is not. Either we should close our eyes totally and we accept blindly whatever the lawyer is giving to us because of the burdening, or we have to seek clarification. I'm simply asked, please kindly provide clarification where it comes from. That's all. That is our right, and we have to really be responded properly. I don't think that for the matter of the time or burdening and so on and so forth, that is not my fault. The situation is that you put a lot of things to the lawyer in a less amount of time, but that is not that we should ignore. So that we should have a trade-off between totally ignoring the accuracy and having something quite accurate. So we have to be quite careful. I once again repeat that I need to have reference where this additional comes from. Thank you.
Thank you, Kavus. I think as Rosemary is saying in the chat, all the edits come from the lawyers. No one else did add anything else. We have a mapping document, which is certainly not perfect, but actually gives us a first attempt. And in no way are we taking everything that's being presented to us as for granted and providing a blank check or anything. And I think the number of questions we've been discussing today is a testimony of that, of the careful review we are doing on the text. I think this is important. If there's anything that is odd in this particular aspect and that we cannot relate to any part of the report, then we've been very careful to highlight it. So with that, I'm moving to the next agenda item, which is an update on ICANN 56. You will remember that we had requested ICANN to host a meeting on the Sunday before this new format B meeting starts. So the format B is just Monday to Thursday. We have this request was presented to the Board Finance Committee, I think it was Tuesday, last Thursday, sorry. We have received an answer from the Board Finance Committee through Teresa and Xavier Calvez, who are confirming that the room will be available for this meeting. Regarding travel support, their response is that they will
encourage us to consider relying on those members of the group who were planning to come to Helsinki, and encourage others to rely on remote participation, which I do understand as not providing extra travel support for the benefit of this meeting for members, but relying on the other existing travel support mechanisms within ICANN to participate to the meeting. I think this is the answer we've received from the Board Finance Committee, and I think it should be welcomed in their flexibility in putting in place a meeting room for our workstream to kick off discussions. We've also had some very useful alignment about how the requests will have to be placed in the future for future potential meetings. And I hope this will set the tone for constructive exchanges in the future. So that's the update we can give on the ICANN 56 Helsinki meeting. I'm not sure whether there are, we will forward this to the email list as well. And if there are any comments at this point about Helsinki, we have about a minute or two. So the meeting will take place, Milton, I'm seeing your question in the chat. The meeting will take place on the Sunday, which is Sunday. I have to look at my schedule.
26?
26, indeed, 26. So Sunday, June the 26th, and Sebastian, please raise your question.
Yes, Sebastian Machure, thank you, Mathieu. Just a short one. Maybe it would be good if all the leadership team from the CCWD are one way or another taking care of ICANN, if they are not already taking care in one or other group, or if they are not coming by themselves. But it's important that at least this core team be in Helsinki to help the group to work. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sebastian. Very kind attention from you. Grateful for that. Certainly, that would be also useful to relay that expectations with the chartering organizations. But I think, Rosemary, to confirm, yes, it's assumed that we would not need counsel at that meeting, which is going to be a kickoff scoping meeting for the workstream two items. So we don't believe counsel is going to be required. Okay, taking into account Sebastian's comment, I think we will clarify this on the mailing list in the coming days to make sure everyone is aware, even if they were not attending this call. With that, I can now turn at the top of the hour to any other business, if any. Okay. I'm seeing none, and so for a change, I think we will try and close right on time. And I thank you again for the great progress we've made today in the comment and review of the draft bylaws, and talk to you tomorrow, 12 UTC, to conclude this review with the last remaining questions, and hopefully for a call that will not be using in the full 2 hours. Thank you very much, everyone. Great work accomplished today. Thank you to our lawyers. and especially to our support staff who have been working tremendously into providing the documentation that's been useful to get clarity on those questions. Thanks, everyone, and have a good day or a good night wherever you are. Cheers.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Thanks, everyone.